Ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
Hello out there, my friends. This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with the return of BOA Audio Season 3. It is May 4th, 2008, and it is great to be back here with all new, fresh episodes of BOA Audio. Let me catch you up to date on a little bit of work we got done over the course of the spring break. I'm happy to report that we have finally fixed the podcast feed. We've taken it in-house. We had a little note up at BOA over the last week or so, but in case you missed that, here's the gist of it. New podcast feed, www.banalofamerica.com/podcast.xml. Grab that URL, punch it into your podcast receiving software or your iTunes, or simply go to iTunes and punch in Banal. We're working on getting the old podcast feed taken off of iTunes. For now, there's two of them on there. You'll know which one's BOA because it has the newest episodes posted, and it will have the BOA logo. Subscribe to that, and you're back to being hooked up to regular BOA audio episodes as they come rolling out. Now, onward into this week's program. It is a barn burner of an episode, my friends. It is definitely a must-hear episode for any serious student of ufology. The guest is Carl Feint of the fantastic website waterufo.net, a tremendous resource for all kinds of fascinating cases, exploring the connection between UFOs and water. So much stuff here that I had either never heard about or even thought about. Carl Feint is doing the research into that stuff. In this hour and change interview, we're going to be talking about why Carl decided to investigate this aspect of ufology, interesting trends and fascinating insights that he's gained from his research, cases that he does not think are related to UFOs, the international aspects of the phenomena, sea monsters, radar and sonar cases, UFOs versus USOs, water wheels, the El Tanin, Shag Harbor, and tons more aquatic-themed esoteric material. As Carl will point out in the beginning of the interview, with the exception of Ivan T. Sanderson and a handful of notes in other books, the water UFO connection has pretty much slipped under the radar of modern day ufology, and there is so much there. It is amazing. And that is why we have Carl Feint here on the program. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Carl Feint, let me give you a little bit of background on him. Carl Feint has been fascinated by aviation since the late days of World War II. Starting with carved balsa replicas and later by flying models of aircraft, he followed his passion into service as a cadet in the Civil Air Patrol. After high school, he studied aircraft engineering at the Academy of Aeronautics in New York City. Following 2 years with the Air Force, a family hardship forced him to return to civilian life, where he joined a major airline, for which he worked in customer service for 34 years. Upon retirement, he was interested in becoming active in ufology, about which he had been reading since the early 1960s. The opportunity came when Jan Aldrich, a UFO researcher, asked for volunteers to do local newspaper searches. Over the course of 8 years, he studied microfilm rolls at the University of Delaware, exhaustively covering the years between 1923 and 1967. He found approximately 750 UFO-related articles, this from the second smallest state in the Union. Intrigued by the fact that aircraft cannot emerge nor submerge into water, he started assembling water-related UFO cases, which have grown into a database of this aspect of the UFO mystery. His website is www.waterufo.net. Definitely want to check this website out. You're going to be sitting there for hours just looking through these water-related UFO cases. Tremendous stuff. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was recorded on April 21st, 2008. Carl Feint, talking about the water UFO connection on BOA Audio Season 3. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Banal of America Audio. My guest is Carl Feint. He is a specialist in the UFO realm, studying the water UFO connection. You can find his website at waterufo.net. He's done just an amazing amount of work compiling and putting together these cases of UFOs related to water, and really trying to come to some kind of conclusion about them and digging out a lot of fascinating details about the water UFO connection, or as some people like to call them, the USOs. I had the opportunity to meet him and interview him at the Mass Monster Mash / Mass UFO show back in October, And already there was a tremendous amount of buzz on just our little 15-minute interview, so I'm really looking forward to sitting down with him here today to talk in depth about the USO phenomenon and the water UFO connection. So, Carl, welcome to Banal of America Audio. It's great to have you back here on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's start on, I guess, with the bio, the background. You know, who is Carl Feint, and how did you get interested in the UFO phenomenon?
Well, I've been interested in aviation since I was knee-high to a grasshopper type. I love aircraft, and, of course, UFOs are some kind of aircraft. And the water angle came on much later, 60s, I started reading about UFOs. And occasionally in a book, you'd run across one case that talked about water. And I said, this is unbelievable. An aircraft goes into the water, it's going to break up, sink, and everything else. These things are popping in and out of water left and right. And I just couldn't get over the fact that nobody was, jumping up and down about it. So finally in 70, Sanderson wrote a book about it, but it was more on the idea of a civilization living under the water rather than how it does get into and out of water. So when I retired, I figured, well, this is where I can pick up being active, and took it from there.
There you go. And like you said, it sounds like the USO thing kind of just came and went with Ivan T. Sanderson. Why do you think it seems like the USOs have kind of fallen between the cracks of the UFO field?
I really don't know. To me, of course, it's totally amazing. I took aeronautical engineering, as it says in the bio, but to me, you know, metal bends and, you know, you can rupture it and everything else. So to have a craft slam into the water and then pop out the other side somewhere is incredible to me. But evidently not too many people thought of it in that respect, and I can't imagine why, but it's becoming bigger now. They're doing more and more on the History Channel with, water UFOs and so forth. But the cases are far and in between, and I think that's probably the reason that it's kind of in the background.
Yeah. Let's talk about waterufo.net, because this website is amazing. I mean, I was diving into it all last night and tonight, no pun intended on the dive, but it's just tremendous. It's monstrous in depth. Where did you get all these different files of UFO, USO cases?
Well, as I said, my problem was the cases are spread out all over the place. They're in journals, books, newsletters, you name it. And it's like one case here, one case there. So Sanderson had 262 cases in his book, but and which I've used, as a matter of fact, but I went to the original reference. But I'm now up to 1,126 cases.
Wow.
Of course, I've also had a few. His book was in 1970, and this is 2008, so I've picked up cases between. But like I said, there's very few publications that had water in them. Lorenzen's book had a chapter of 10 pages. Flying Saucer Review used to have like a couple of articles every so often. UFOs from underseas, this, that, and the other thing. And so what I've been doing technically is scraping everything together, and my website has grown from nothing, about 100 cases, I think, or 200 cases, up to its present size, mainly because I keep picking them up here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah, I really got to give it to you. Just tremendous kudos on just the depth of the stuff on the website. I was just amazed by how many cases were there and just the amount of research that you've done on the USO phenomenon. It's just amazing.
Fortunately, I'm retired.
There you go. I'm sure that helps. And when we were talking before we did, when we were setting up the interview and stuff, you mentioned that something about Ted Phillips and the trace cases sort of piqued your interest about the water connection to the UFOs. Can you extrapolate on that whole thing?
Well, I'm a very big fan of Ted Phillips. I mean, we have too much sociology, psychology, philosophy, and ufology. And Ted's the only one who's digging in the ground to find out what the UFO does to the ground, does to the trees, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing he never tackled that I know of is water. And so I said to myself, well, Ted's not doing it, so I said, maybe I can put my paws in there and see what I can come up with. And it's been that way ever since. I met him at one of the MUFON conferences, as a matter of fact. I followed him. Tough act to follow, by the way. But I have a great deal of respect for him and what he does. And I was hoping that somehow water could reveal some of the thing. It has to me, anyway, what the UFO actually does.
Yeah, and you said that he didn't do the water element. Did you ever ask him, like, why that was the case, or did it even come up at all?
No, to tell you the truth, we didn't. We sat at the table talking about every other kind of thing, you know, cars being lifted, this, that, and the other thing, but we never got into my interest of the thing. Of course, I guess he was waiting to see what I had to say at the convention, so at the symposium.
Yeah.
But we were having such a good time, we didn't even think of it.
Seems like most of the time the talk centers around non-UFO related stuff anyway, so.
Yeah. No, he, as a matter of fact, he sent me an email once and congratulated me on my website. He had hit it looking for a particular case, and I had to tell him that it was a hoax, or at least we signed off as a hoax. But I really respect the man's efforts, and he spends a lot of money and time on this thing as well.
He's done some great work and stuff, and you're right there behind him with the stuff on USOs. I mean, it's tremendous. That website is awesome. It's a tool that should be used by so many researchers, and I have a feeling it is being picked up by so many people. On the page here on the website, let me look at it here. On the page, why is this site necessary? You say that that you hope to break down these sightings statistically. Have you gotten to that point yet where you're bringing out some hard numbers here as far as the USO sightings go?
Well, I was thinking about I wrote that probably the first day I put the website up. You know? I was looking for somebody to come and give me help, but I haven't. Statistics in this area are really poor, you know. When you're talking about the height of the craft above the water, everything's estimates and colors. I'd love to have a database to put this thing all through, but I really don't have that kind of a database. I have cases all in date order, and that other part that's right below where it says other topics of interest, that's basically my breaking these cases down on what I've found out about, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's the most important part right now to me, because when you group these cases together as to what they're doing, they make more and more sense, you know, as to how the craft is reacting with the water. Physical influence on water, that third one down on the right hand side, that one is my bright bulb on my head. That thing woke me up in no short order. I couldn't sleep that night when I did that thing. It was something unbelievable. And that's all different groups. There's four groups, and each one has witnesses that see each of these type of within the group. But when you put them all together, it spells mama. it really comes up. It's a fantastic thing, and this made me a true believer in UFOs. I've been with UFOs, like I said, since the early 60s, but this one told me, yes, they are real. There's no question of it in my mind.
Well, there you go. Now, let's sort of start then, I guess, with that category, because I'm hoping to go down some of these categories and talk to you about some of them. But since that one seemed to have such a profound effect on you, let's talk about that one.
Okay.
Tell me what you've figured out here about the physical effects on water.
Okay, well, basically the four groups, people see water being bulging up as the UFO comes up out of the water. I mean, they have no conception that a UFO is coming up. They just see this strange anomaly in the water, a mounding, a bubble-like thing. And then all of a sudden the UFO pops up out of it. Then we go to the second category, and that's a depression in the water. The UFO's just about, say, equal with the water, and below it, there's a hole in the water or a depression. The fourth one is really only one case, but it's the right guy, right place scenario. The UFO is slightly higher yet, and still close to the water, but now it's kind of, the water is mounding up under it, like a mountain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the category four. And then category five is the biggest one. That's called the water spout. Now, that's water being sucked up to the UFO from the surface of the water. And four different groups, it drove me nuts. I was sitting down one night, I put up yet another water case, and the problem to me was I couldn't relate one case to the other. There was no connecting influence on this thing.
Yeah.
So I sat down. I was aeronautical engineering. I still got my drafting board. So I said, I'm going to make the drawing. I'm going to start from the lowest one, go up to the highest one, and see if there's anything that visually I can see, you know, joining the four groups together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I finished it, it's the field or surrounding the UFO. It was like a light. I can't describe it because it was so spectacular in my head. I just couldn't sleep all night long. The rotation of the field describes everything the UFO is doing. The water bulging and making a kind of a bubble on the surface is when the UFO is under, it's pushing the water up and out. When the UFO is depressing the water, it's because the field is rotating down into the water and pushing the water away. So you're not, when you're looking at it, you don't see the field. You just see the UFO and a hole in the water.
Mm-hmm.
But the field is actually creating that hole. The mounding is when it's above the surface. The field is returning into the UFO from into the bottom. And what's doing is dragging the water with it. And it's kind of a suction because of the rapid motion of the field. And then, of course, the water spout is the final part of it. It's just that it's up higher, still got the suction or vortex under it, and it appears to be sucking water into the UFO, which it isn't. That's a byproduct. It's like prop wash.
Yeah, and you have an excellent drawing here on that page at waterufo.net. When they go down to physical influences of a UFO on water, there's a tremendous graphic here kind of describing what you're saying. Kind of can think of it as a sideways eight. Being the field, rotating one side going clockwise, the other side going counterclockwise, and the middle being sort of like the center of the UFO.
Right.
And that thus creates sort of a circular thing going on around the UFO, the field, if you will.
Yeah. That's the actual picture that I drew.
Oh, nice, nice.
I scanned that and pasted it in there, so that's the actual picture that I drew.
Yeah, I highly recommend people check that out because that'll really give them an idea of what we're trying to convey here. Now, as far as that's sort of like the physical effect on the water, have there been any sort of studies as far as, I guess you could say, trace cases, if you will, on the water, you know, any ill effects that have become onto the water as a result of the UFO being in there?
Well, I have another paper that I haven't published yet on the web. I'm going to hold it off for the book. It's called Heat and Water UFOs, and there's heat in various categories, which, again, is on that home page under in the rain, in the snow, through the ice. All of those have to do with the field, which is extremely hot. And I think you're familiar with the Cash Landrum case.
Mm-hmm.
And needless to say, that melted the asphalt on the highway. And when Betty tried to get back into the car, the handle of the car was so hot, she burned herself. She had to use a coat as an insulator. So needless to say, this field is extremely hot, and that's a trace. That's a trace. And it creates steam and water, causes bubbling. And all these are different traces that show that field, that rotating field, is hot. Of course, now I'm also getting to the point where I get to UFO making ice, which is kind of difficult to describe. I have no pictures of it on the web right now. But I'm going to get into that as well.
Like literally going into the water and somehow creating an ice situation?
Well, not going into the water. That field that rotates around a UFO, they can reverse the field. I've proven that in the abduction cases. And they can also turn it off. Now, if they turn the field off, you've got the opposite situation. It's no longer hot. It's actually ice cold. And I believe it's due to something close to what a absolute zero.
Yeah.
You know, that's 459 degrees below zero.
Yeah.
And so any of that, this cold mass of air is circulating over the water, and it can freeze water because of that.
Interesting, interesting.
Yeah.
And then one of the big categories you have here, aircraft carriers and other large ships. It sounds like that's where you get a lot of the reports, probably because with some of these ships, you have so many people on board that you know, you get a lot of good sightings and corroborating reports and stuff like that. Would you say that's one of the more predominant areas of USO sightings?
Really not.
Wow.
I hate to destroy you, but the reason I put that up is because there were so many aircraft carriers coming in on various levels. Sonar, radar, and then I only have one case where I was seen going into or coming out of the water. But I have a lot of big ships in there besides aircraft carriers. I've got a battleship in World War II that fired on UFOs and a destroyer, too.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, that's the 1942 and the 1945 cases. But I kind of put that in because I have another category called up close and personal.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of reports that don't actually alter water in any way, shape, or form, but it's ships on water, and they're seeing various things like the UFOs in the air.
Yeah.
And it does various things. It emanates heat and whatever have you. And you don't want to throw these reports away because they're good reports. So anyway, that's my kind of not a trash can, but a holding cell, you might say, for reports that don't fit my water category. But by the same token, aircraft carriers are about the same thing, but they also have radar and sonar, and I like that, you know, because that they are actually tracking things that in the air coming towards the carrier or underwater, you know, below the carrier. So I figured that would be a separate category. And I've gotten a couple of responses from that through my website.
What kind of cases do you have in that regard as far as USOs being picked up on sonar or radar?
Well, basically, it is they picked something up. I have ships that in one particular case, there was a thing about an island. They thought they were navigating over an unknown island in the Pacific. And the problem was the island started moving and going down deep.
Whoa.
And they're picking this up on the sonar. And needless to say, islands don't do that. But they were en route to some other port, and while they were tracking, they said, well, we got this thing here, it's not on our chart, so we'll put it down. Well, needless to say, that's a true USO, that's an unidentified submerged object. But there's a lot of radar cases. There's one particular one, I can't think of it, which it is offhand, but there's one where a guy was talking about them picking it up on radar, and then watching it zoom down towards the water. Well, of course, you lose radar contact at that point.
Yeah.
And then immediately sonar picked it up. And they said it was zigzagging down as it was going down. It was zigzagging underwater. So, I mean, some kind of control was on the craft as it manipulated underwater.
That's interesting. That's a true USO, I guess you could say. Huh?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then another subject here that I found interesting, death in the water.
Oh, dead in the water. Yeah, that is very interesting.
Talk about some of these cases in the dead in the water section, and you make a great point here for future ufologists, it says, to have the specimens analyzed.
Right. Well, there's only one case in all of those, probably 12, I guess. I don't know how many there actually are. But the main thing is only one case actually took the fish to a laboratory to be examined.
Mm-hmm.
And the conclusion was that it was a concussion type thing where it had ruptured organs. It might be true, but by the same token, I think it's the field, really. It's either electrocuting them or radiating the fish or something. But you don't have, in any of those cases, a means of death. And almost all those cases are fish. However, I should also point out there's ducks in one particular case, ducks and geese that were found dead floating in the water where a UFO had popped out of a pond. And another one with two dead professional divers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, there's a lot of interesting the thing is, again, you have these people who don't associate the death of these things with the UFO. As a matter of fact, funny story, I was up at a convention in Nova Scotia with Chris Lyle and Don Ledger.
Yep.
And Chris was doing a video, in any event, at the very end, he's just about finished, and he says, oh, by the way, I just thought of it. He says, a week later, dead fish were found floating in Shag Harbor. This is the big Shag Harbor incident, by the way.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I said, Chris, when the hell are you going to tell me, you know? But people don't associate it, you know. It's just one of those, well, something happened after, you know. And that's what happens. They're dead. They don't come swimming to the shore by themselves, but they get washed up with the tide eventually.
Yeah, and it's the sort of thing that happens maybe a couple of days later or something like that, and people mm-hmm. don't make the connection.
You know, the thing is, that's, again, another trace. For some reason, the UFO is causing death, not to all the fish around it, but evidently the ones up close to it. Now, that, like, again, it could be electrocution, like lightning hits the water, and it doesn't kill all the fish in the ocean. It only kills those in the immediate vicinity of the lightning hit, and it dissipates as it goes out. So it's only the fish that are close, and I think that's what's happening, is the fish that are close to the UFO are the ones dying, not the ones further out.
Yeah, and to stay on the subject of fish here, what about the section fish reactions to a USO?
Well, that was another thing I'd kind of overlooked. I got help from Miss Joan Woodward. She did a fantastic job on animal reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I had asked her some questions, and then she helped me out with that in there. The thing is, again, you have people are amazed by the UFO. They're not looking in the water to see what the fish are doing. They're looking at the UFO for the most part. But in some cases, people did notice things about the fish. And I had one particular case, no, it's not in this one, as a matter of fact. It's not in this one because it had other features, and it's not in this category. But the guy goes underwater. He sees a UFO turn itself off, and he sees it glowing underwater, and then he sees it go black. So he swims down towards it, and he noticed various things about the UFO. I can go on, but I won't take up too much time. But he says at some point he heard a little like a bell thing, next thing you know, he says the fish all of a sudden shot off like rockets. They were terrified.
Huh.
And he says just then he noticed the water getting warmer. Again, this is the heat thing with the UFO. Once that field starts up, you've got it heating everything around it, you know.
Yeah.
So in the event, these are all effects that these fish kind of sense something. It's either danger, sound, or who knows what. But we don't know enough, and I've just tried to pinpoint the various aspects of what's in all these stories. You know, the trouble is, it's not everything is in the same story. You get one story emphasizes this, another story emphasizes something else.
Yeah.
But when you put them all together, that's when you start finding answers.
Exactly, yeah. I'm sure that you've heard the concept, I guess, elsewhere, but where did you come up with the whole idea of the field theory of, you know, UFO powering and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, I didn't invent the field. There's nothing about that. No, the ball of light thing has been in since I, you know, started reading about UFOs. It's a light phenomenon at night, not during the day, but at night. And I'm sure you're familiar with Paul Hill's book, Unconventional Flying Objects, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a fantastic book. That's my Bible. And he goes into the thing as to why you see it as a ball of light at night and not during the day. Evidently, the sun's rays cancel out the color thing, and so you don't see the field during the daytime. But the field is there. And at night, of course, it's ionizing the air, and it's dark. And so according to the power setting on this thing, is what the color you see. You can go from red, orange, yellow, and then back up, you know, the spectrum. But the field was there all the time. But how the field operated was the mystery to me. You know, I mean, is it a static field? Is it just sitting there like an invisible glass or plastic? No, it's a rotating field. And the reason I found out it was rotating is because of that very thing about how it affects the water. Pushing water up, pushing it down. You don't, if it's a static field, it's not pushing anything. It's just there. but it is pushing, so the field has to be rotating. And the rotating field explains a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting, and I like the way you've used the water UFOs to sort of, to help flesh this whole thing out. Now, if someone sees, do you have cases where someone sees a USO underwater, and in that instance, does it appear like that it's inside of a bubble almost?
I've never had it, any of the cases described as such. They say it's, there's a light underwater. They look at a glowing ball just like they would at night. Of course, the water's dark, and it's ionizing the water as well as the air. And so you see a ball underneath, not a, a craft. Now, like I said, this other case I had from South America, the guy saw the light under the water, and it was obviously large, and it scared him. And next thing he says, it parked like 200 feet away from him and turned off. Turn the light off, which means they turn the field off. Well, he couldn't have gotten near the UFO if the field was on.
Yeah.
He'd be one of those dead professional divers. But he went up, touched the craft, and so needless to say, the field was not active at the time.
Talk a little bit about that story here with the dead professional divers, because I'm surprised that kind of thing, I don't even ever recall hearing this story, so obviously it must have sort of been overlooked, I guess, in UFO lore, because I don't really know too much about this. What's the story with that?
Well, I'm not that familiar with it off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But as I have there in yellow, 2 days after the crash, two fishermen who were the best divers in the area were found dead and naked on the nearby rocks. Now, they weren't necessarily diving naked. Of course, when you die, your body swells and it rips your clothes off. So that's the reason why probably naked. There were only two who had enough courage to dive where the buoy was. Now, when they're talking about that, that was evidently what was reported as the UFO. They thought it was a buoy, and it wasn't. It was the UFO. They reported to their colleagues that they had seen a disc-shaped object half buried underwater. The ocean water around the disc was terribly hot, so they could not touch it. Again, the heat thing comes back in again. This goes over on and on and on and on. The heat thing, I got to talk about that. Don Ledger sent me a case I had asked him for. It was in his book, The Maritime Files.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, what intrigued me was two women are coming out of some store or something, and they see a UFO hovering in the rain. And they said above the UFO was a mist. Now, rain is coming vertically down, right?
Yeah.
And it's hitting the UFO field. Now, when it hits that hot field, it's not mist. It's turning to steam. And that's what they're looking at. Mist, steam, fog, all of these are interrelated. You know, they're all white molecules of water. And so whatever you want to call it, it's water, it's steam when it's around a UFO, that's for sure.
Yeah, interesting. That's very interesting. You make a good point here on the page here on waterufo.net that you're not a big proponent of missing ships being blamed on UFOs. So no, that's a good thing.
No, I hate that thing. The trouble is they try to identify UFOs with everything, you know,
yeah.
And it's a bad point. First of all, no one's ever reported a ship hijacked or abducted by a UFO. No one. But just because you have ships missing, then all of a sudden the mystery is, did a UFO abduct it? Well, now they have this thing on History Channel. They had the, what do they call it, the rogue wave, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they said there's no doubt that many ships have been sunk because of the rogue wave. I also have a thing where a commander of a ship way back when said that due to his knowledge of meteor hitting the ocean and very close to one particular ship, it was covered in the New York Times, as a matter of fact, he says there's no doubt that some of these ships had no warning and suddenly were struck by a meteor and sank immediately. So you've got multiple reasons for ships going missing. It kind of scares you to go on an ocean liner nowadays. But not a UFO. I mean, you got to have some place to store the dang ship.
Yeah.
You know, it's an unstable thing outside of water. So why would they want to take one on board a saucer? I have no conception of that. Don't like it at all.
There you go, yeah. Well, I'm glad we debunked that whole thing. You sound like you're a little puzzled here on the section through the ice, because in some instances the USO or UFO will go in through the ice over a body of water, and some instances it'll be, you know, circular, and other times it'll be all smashed up. So what do you make of the ice factor, I guess you could say, with the USOs?
Okay, well, the UFO field is very hot, as I said. So now when this thing descends vertically to the ice, the field is touching the ice and instantly melting it. So you have a clean hole in the water. But there are several cases in that group where the UFO is actually shooting down across the shoreline and then into the ice from there. Well, now the field is not vertically above the ice. It's coming, pushing its way through the ice. So you've got kinetic energy as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure some of the ice has melted, but the force of the impact is what's breaking up the ice.
And then I guess to stay on the cold part, what do you have here on USOs in the snow, the connection with the snow?
Well, again, it's the melting. This all comes under my heat category because snow is, of course, a different form of water, so as is ice. So it's just yet one more category where you can take a trace from the UFO. I think in some of them, in the snow, is nothing more than knocking snow off branches. And again, this is not the UFO that's knocking the branches. It's the field that's knocking the branches.
Yeah.
So, basically what you have is a hole in the snow where the field is. And one of my friends had said, well, Carl, it could be compression. The UFO lands on it and next thing it compresses the snow, which would cause the snow to melt. But the UFOs don't land flat on their craft. They usually put landing gears down. And what you have is not just a tripod landing gear impression. What you have is a 30-foot circle.
Yeah.
That means the entire field is melting the snow. So, again, that's a trace, but it's again, a trace of what? The only thing that can explain it is the field. The field is hot, it melts the snow, and bang, that's what you got. And in many cases, it not only melts the snow, but it melts evaporates the water and causes a singeing of leaves and things underneath it.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, you're talking about a very, very hot field.
Yeah. Is there any situations with, like, I guess you could say, like, snow circles, crop circle type situation with snow? Do you know anything about that?
There was one where snow swirled. I know that. But that's due to the vortex under the UFO. That vortex is the same thing that does the sucking up of water, making a water spout.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is the same thing that lifts cars up on the road. There's a lot of cases where somebody says, we lost control of the car. The steering wheel, you know, we could turn it any direction, but the car kept going straight ahead. We hit the brakes and nothing happened. This is all because the car is actually maybe, it could be a half inch, quarter inch, could be a foot, you know, off the road. You lose all, you can hit the gas pedal, but you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, that's because the craft is physically lifting the UFO, not intentionally necessarily. It passes over the car, and it's the vortex under the UFO that's doing the lifting. I got one case, the Falcon Lake one, where the guy got the radiation burns.
Mm-hmm.
And in that particular case, they said it was sucking up leaves, grass, and dirt. You know, and the rock surface was clean in a 15-foot circle. So this vortex does a lot of damage, but not intentionally. Like I said, it's like prop wash. You know, you get stuff blowing across the field because of the prop wash. But this is a circular field, like a small tornado, if you will, and it's sucking up things below it.
Fascinating. This is fascinating stuff. And I see here also you kind of float the idea that maybe some of these classic sea monster reports might be USOs.
Well, technically, that sea monster, I have one really good one, and that came to me from another researcher. He says, you got to put this one up. And after reading it, I said, yeah, you're absolutely right, I do. The thing that's very important about the big one, that's Puget Sound, July of 1893. Old. That's way before UFOs. But the description is very lengthy. And the thing is, these guys go out, two people go out towards the sea monster. And next thing you know, they're shocked, electrically shocked.
Huh.
Now, they're talking about the sea monster having eight eyes. I don't know of anything that's 150 feet long, has eight eyes, and can electrocute somebody. Fortunately, these people didn't die. They were shocked, but they were knocked out. They weren't electrocuted. They weren't killed. But the thing is, eight eyes could be windows in the UFO.
Yeah.
Rather than eyes. And again, 150 feet is the length of this thing. That's, I don't know if, you know, any particular sea monster that, you know, fits that category. But it was beautiful. I had to insert all my little comments in there in a different color so that people knew it was me and not the story. But it was a very long story on that particular sea monster.
Yeah, I think I recall reading that one. It was a really enjoyable piece there.
You must know a lot of ocean songs.
I do. Here's the sea ditty my mother taught me. Love, exciting and new. Come aboard. We're expecting you. And love, life's sweetest reward. Let it flow.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
It flows back to you, the love boat. Soon we'll be making another run.
Before I start going into some of these other subjects, I know you said you haven't really looked at it statistically, but would you say, how would you describe your average, I guess you could say, USO sighting? Generally going into the water or coming out of the water or both? Or in the water altogether, you know, submerged?
Both, I would say. A lot of times, I have one particular case by an airline pilot who had 40 years service and never saw a UFO. He bought a house in Puget Sound, an island out in Puget Sound, and he's looking out of his evidently enormous window, and he sees what he thought was an aircraft going into the water. Well, he was all set to phone it in when all of a sudden the thing came out of the water. Then it went back into the water. Then it came out of the water. Then it went back into the water. Well, this kept going on until it passed his window, you know, where he couldn't see anymore. Evidently, the UFO was having so much fun going in and out of the water that, you know, it just it did it as a playful thing, you know. So, I mean, it's not that they have to go in for any particular reason, or they have to come out for any particular reason. I kind of look at them as like atomic subs that can float around down there forever if they wanted to. Their fuel supplies are evidently unbelievable. So.
And I recall when we talked in October, you said that these aren't just isolated to oceans. I mean, you've gotten these USO reports for just about every kind of body of water there is, right?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, that one with the dead ducks and geese, that was a pond. Well, of course, a pond can be viewed as a small lake. I've got them coming out of lagoons. I've got them of streams, rivers. You name the body of water, I've got it.
That's a good thing to say, because I was just going to say, what about swimming pools?
No. I don't think I have a single swimming pool around. There's been a couple of things I'm kind of nervous about. I really don't like swimming pools. A swimming pool is not 30 feet, and most UFOs are in that category, you know, scout ships.
Yeah.
I have seen them as small as 10 feet across. Well, even 10 feet across, you know, is kind of wide for a swimming pool.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't believe swimming pools. People might have seen fireflies coming out of the thing, but I doubt very much if it was a UFO.
Okay, well, I figured I'd throw that out there in case you never know. You might have had some crazy story about a swimming pool one that I hadn't heard yet. Now, we've already sort of talked about the illusion that the UFO is taking on water, but you also have a section here on conventional situations where they're taking on water, and you ponder the idea if their power system is derived from H2O, do you think it is, or why do you think that in some of these instances and cases you have where the UFO is taking on water?
I think it's more biological or something. I mean, we use water to drink, and it's part of our system, and most life on this planet uses water one way or another, even if it's mixed with sulfuric acid, as it was on one particular program. But I don't think it's part of their power plant. Otherwise, they'd have to go from water planet to water planet. And I don't think that's so.
Yeah.
I view it more like a nuclear submarine. That thing's power plant, that uses water as well, a nuclear submarine, but that's primarily to create the steam to drive the ship and so forth. But I don't think that's the case in the UFO. I really don't.
Okay.
There's one thing I want to do, too. Water wheels. I don't know if you had that on your itinerary, but that comes under this misidentified thing in ufology where, you know, with the missing ships and all that. Water wheels are real. It is a real phenomenon. They're both circular and they're in wave patterns, and there was a scientist who wrote about it. But they don't know what causes it. And the thing is, it's only, well, 99.9% of them only occur in the Indian Ocean. Now, that's the place where you have all these seismic events, you know, the tsunamis, the seismic events.
Mm-hmm.
And so yet, everybody sees it as a mystery, and of course it has to be equated with UFOs because they go into the water and therefore they must cause these things. I don't believe so. I think it's really a seismic thing, especially where it's in a particular area on the planet.
Yeah, so we can cross those off of USOs.
Right.
Sounds good to me. We did sort of touch on it in October, but let's sort of revisit this some of these stories you have of beings coming off the ship and looking for the water. Just sort of stay on that unconventional taking on of water, because some of those stories are pretty wild and pretty fascinating stuff. So talk a little bit about those.
Okay. I really don't I can't get fascinated myself about them. I mean, they come down, they put a hose in the water, and they take on water. They take a bucket, and they ask the guy, can I have a bucket of water? You know, this is fine. You know, it's the collection of water for some particular purpose, which we don't know. Maybe they're watering plants on the airplane. I have no idea. But in any event, the thing is, this section got divided into two parts because the UFO takes on water supposedly by itself while it's hovering over water. Now, if you had that ability to suck water into your craft, why would you need hoses and buckets, tubes, and everything else?
Yeah.
You wouldn't. So evidently, that suction that's below the UFO has absolutely nothing to do with taking water into the ship. Water, by the way, in a tornado-type cloud, a water spout, the main part of the water is actually down towards the surface. The higher it gets, the more molecular it becomes. Well, if you're sucking in molecules of water, you're not taking a whole lot of water into the ship.
Yeah. These stories of the people, of the, you know, the occupants, let's say, who come off and look for the water, chronologically, are those older stories than we would hear nowadays? Because it seems like back in the 50s and earlier, or the 60s, around, you know, before the 70s and 80s and 90s, seemed like that they were getting out of the ships more often than they are now. You don't hear too many occupant stories. What would you say, you know, as far as stories where the occupants are getting out of the ships and stuff, are those older cases?
Well, I've got one from 1897, as you know, but we go all the way up to 2001.
Oh, wow.
I've got one for March 22nd, 2001. It's the last one I had put in. And the figure was holding something resembling a hose and was apparently sucking water from the river and into the craft. So there you go, the hose thing again, the sucking water from a river. So, I mean, and this is 2001. So the trouble is a lot of these cases come late. I have a new case, as a matter of fact, it has nothing to do with the water thing, but I just got it in the mail a few days ago, and the guy's talking about September 1981. So you never know what date you're going to wind up with a case. It all depends on when somebody gets a bug and says, hey, I'm going to tell somebody about it.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's countless ones that never get reported in the first place.
Oh, yes, yes.
Talk about the Elatonin, the thing on the ocean floor, because that was pretty interesting stuff.
Well, it was interesting to us because we knew what it was, and the Elatonin was a thing that looks like a radio antenna. It It's vertical and horizontal as well. And when I say horizontal, I mean completely horizontal. Like tubes coming out of another tube, you know, at 90-degree angles. Well, in any event, this whole thing started from somebody seeing this thing from one of these geological survey ships, you know. And next thing you know, he assumes that this is a strange thing on the ocean floor, and it's probably a alien antenna. Well, from that point on, it became up, up, and up, all UFO, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, with absolutely no verification of it whatsoever. So anyway, myself, Larry Hatch, I forget the other two researchers that mentioned in that article, they finally found that it is well known in biology, this particular thing that grows on the ocean floor. It's known. They had pictures of it in a book, showing it both wet and in its normal condition, and when it was dried, a little dried and kind of shabby and hanging down and all. But in any event, Larry Hatch was one of the researchers on this thing, and he was the only one who had a website to put it up on. So at the time, and so Larry was collecting all the data that four of us could put together, and Larry was getting death threats. You know, said, you know, crazy guy, you're lying through your teeth, you know, da da da, because they wanted to believe so hard that this thing was really a UFO thing.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's a natural growth.
Yeah, that's par for the course in the UFO world, it seems.
Well, it's scary when somebody starts doing it and then other people latch on to it like it's some kind of religion. And it's wrong. It's wrong. We can't maintain our dignity in ufology if we adopt all these strange things. We've got to knock those out as well.
Yeah, exactly. And sort of on that subject, there's always been, and you sort of said that actually with the Ivan T. Sanderson thing too, there's always been sort of that idea that the UFOs are here and that they're coming from underwater bases type situation. What's your thoughts on that whole thing?
Well, I don't view them as a civilization underwater. I mean, they had that movie, The Abyss, you know, where the guy goes all the way down to the bottom eventually, and there's a civilization down there. And, of course, that civilization comes to the surface at the end of the movie with ships sitting on it, you know. But, no, I don't go for the civilization. I will go for bases. There are a lot of abductee tales about, you know, being underwater, not a lot, several of, being underwater and being taken into a mountainside or something underwater. There's a what you call a Spartan base, you know, it's not very elegant, it's kind of like a militaristic base. And I have no doubt that they might have some bases here just, you know, for repair or, you know, who knows, a rest stop, you know, something to get out of the craft and walk around or whatever. But nothing on a major scale. I don't think there's anything down there that's major. Of course, I could be wrong.
Well, there's a lot of water out there in the world, so it would be hard to really know for sure. The depths of the ocean of the world are pretty unexplored, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, especially the Pacific. That's the biggest hole in this planet.
Now, is there any sort of geographical, you know, area where it is predominantly where you get a lot of the USO sightings, or is it pretty much spread all over the world?
All over the world. I always get a kick out of that because, you know, you think it's only the crazy Americans that are doing this thing. And that's the reason my website is I get every UFO case I can get. And you can just about plug in. I got that list of sightings page. You click on that, and then you go down. There's a search engine down there. It says keyword here. And you just got to type in whatever country you want. I don't care which country it is. Just stick it in there, and you'll probably come up with a UFO case. Now, how about Switzerland? Landlocked Switzerland, huh?
Yeah.
Lake Geneva. And there's a case there for it.
There you go. Well, what about the Middle East? Probably not, because it's all desert.
Oh, I don't know about that. Give me a country.
Iraq.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Wow. So you get 6 cases just in Iraq. That's amazing.
Persian Gulf, past the Strait of Hormuz towards India, unknown position in the Persian Gulf off Mina al-Hamani, Kuwait. So, bingo. You know, you can't go wrong. You plug the name into the search engine, and you can come up with your country.
Yeah, I gotta give you props not just for the depth of stuff on the website, but the easy navigation of the website too. It's really tremendous as far as doing that sort of cross reference type stuff.
This thing came up from ground zero, and as I work with it, you know, you keep saying, well, this is wrong, and you change things as you go. So, it's worked into a pretty good system of, knowledge finding, and, like that other page with the, other things of interest, that grew slowly. That only had like one or two things on it, but now I'm, as you can see, I got a whole lot of stuff in there.
Yeah.
The abductees in water, by the way, is a very interesting thing by itself as well. And it proves that the field does hold water off because these guys are underwater and they're looking through the windshield. They said the water never touched the windshield.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was talking about the bubble idea, actually, earlier when I asked you if it looked like a bubble. So maybe if you're on the inside, it does look like you're on the inside of a bubble.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, two abductees called it a tunnel. And one abductee called it a tube. Now, when you're looking out the window, you're looking at a curved wall, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's a tube or a tunnel doesn't matter, but that's what you're looking at. You're not looking at a tunnel. You're looking at the field. And in each case, they said the walls weren't made of stone. They were like soft. In one case, they said soft. In another way, they said it was translucent, like firmed water. So, that's what they're looking at. They're looking at the field holding the water off.
That's amazing. That's amazing stuff.
It is.
And, of course, there's always the argument that, you know, is thrown at the UFOs that these could be government craft and it's test craft, that kind of thing. How do you feel about that with regards to USOs? Are you pretty skeptical that they're not something? Obviously, with the sheer time that's gone on with these sightings, it sounds unlikely, but even contemporary times, what do you think about the idea that maybe there could be some kind of, you know, secret black project going on with relation to this?
They might be trying to do, as you know from the Cash Landrum thing, that UFO was escorted by 23 helicopters. So needless to say, they're developing something. But I don't think this is new. I think that might be from the captured sources things, that, you know, the Roswell, if you want to go that route.
Mm-hmm.
But whether they have crash saucers and back engineering, that's quite a possibility. But being the original, no. These things go way back, and needless to say, back that far, we didn't have the technology.
Yeah.
I don't know if you interviewed Keith Chester about his Foo Fighter book.
Oh yeah, yep. We had Keith on like in November, one of our most popular interviews this season so far. And I was going to draw the parallel between his work and yours because you're both kind of in this specialized area, but you're doing a tremendous job of collating these cases.
Well, I'm in his acknowledgement section because for 4 years I was beating him over the head to write the book. I said, he was at one point a little bit disappointed in thinking about giving it up. And I said, you got an inside track. I said, we need that information. And one of the things that I was going to bring up is, you know, when you're talking about old cases, whenever we talk about Roswell, it happened in 47. Of course, 47 was the beginning of ufology. However, the military knew about UFOs in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So when they heard the word of a crash saucer, needless to say, they reacted quickly to cover it up and get it. So it's not like this was a sudden surprise, you know, because they wouldn't have known what the hell to do. But they were prepared for it because of the stuff that happened during World War II.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. There's a timeline is starting to emerge as we get further into researching the history of the UFO phenomenon and the history of what they knew, it seems.
Exactly.
One of the last things of the categories I wanted to ask you about here was beams of light into water, because
mm-hmm.
that sounds pretty interesting and different from some of the other stuff we've talked about so far.
Yeah, well, it is very interesting. It's not the only, they don't only put a beam of light into water. I'm sure you know about the Randlesham thing in England.
Mm-hmm.
The colonel had a beam of light fall right at his feet. And, so it's not unusual, but why are they putting it into water? Now, they could be using possibly the light as a communication with another craft that's underwater. I only have one case in that whole group where somebody said they thought they saw a fish in the beam being, you know, brought up. So, again, you have that kind of an abductee beam, you know, that's beamed down, and they're beaming something up into the ship. But all the other cases, all I have is it is a beam of light into the water. And you got to wonder what they find so interesting that they have to put a beam of light into the water for. So that's kind of one of those unsolved things, but it is part of ufology.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a side thing here, I'm going to be talking to Bill Chalker soon, and I see you have the thing here on water NASA.
You're going to be talking to Chalker?
Tonight.
Oh, fantastic. That was a fantastic thing. It's 26 pages long, that whole thing. And it's an excellent study of what happened. And again, what you have is that vortex under the UFO creating the water spout, kind of. It didn't actually, by that time he saw it, it was above the tree line and zooming away. But what he did say was the water was going around in a circle, and that the reeds had been pulled out. That's because of the force of the vacuum of the vortex. And it finally came to the surface later on in the day. So here's the only one where a UFO is actually seen leaving the site of a created crop circle. So, yes, this is a very important one to me because, again, it proves the vortex under the UFO.
Yeah, exactly. By looking at all these water UFO cases, we can sort of learn a lot about what's going on. You've already sort of talked about the field theory, but what other sort of stuff have you gleaned from the vast number of USO cases that you've looked at?
Well, it's primarily the heat, for one. Again, the field through the eyes of the witness, the UFO abductees, they're looking out windows from inside the craft at the field. So, again, you have confirmation of that field. So I know what the field is. I know that there is a field. I know how it rotates. I know from, again, Unconventional Flying Objects, the book, that it moves molecules of air so fast that you never get the shock wave buildup, you know, the compression in front of the craft.
Yeah.
And exactly what it's doing with air is what it's doing with water. As soon as it encounters water, it's moving it to the back. And that's the reason these things can enter water, and it says it barely created a ripple on the surface of the water. That's because they're moving water in 360 degrees, you know, outward. And then it's being pulled backward as they go deeper and deeper in. So I can tell you everything except what that field is composed of. I have no idea what it's composed of. I have no idea about the engine. I'll tell you one thing. The field has nothing to do with its travel. I know that because you can shut the field off and that thing will still hover. Now, if the field's off, how can it hover unless it has a separate propulsion system?
Yeah. So you think maybe the field is some kind of protection system?
Oh,
perhaps?
I know it's a protection system. As a matter of fact, AP put out a thing that was on Yahoo about the space station and how they had sent up, Russians had gone up with panels to fasten in place to protect the space station from meteor hits. And we've got some kind of a primitive system where we have like three different walls, and when a meteor hits the outer wall and pierces it, there's stuff inside to, again, chop it up a little finer, and then if it goes through the second wall, there's some more stuff in between to chop it up a little more. Of course, if it goes through the third wall, you're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
So, in any event, if this craft is traveling at fantastic speeds, and meteors are traveling at fantastic speeds, the collision between the two would leave your craft useless.
Exactly.
So I'm really scared about this idea of going to Mars. I mean, we had enough trouble with one shot at the moon and Apollo 13. And here they're looking to do the same thing, and they could have rocks hitting the spaceship on its way to Mars.
We're going to have to make our own field.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. These guys are experienced in the technology, and they know they need something to deflect all the small stuff that they can't detect in advance. I mean, if you see a big rock up ahead and it's on your radar, you can manipulate around it. But if you have the small stuff hitting it, it's just as deadly. It's like bullets instead of a cannon shell. So you still got to have protection. And that's the reason people can shoot at these things, throw rocks at them, and it doesn't affect the UFO at all because nothing's hitting the UFO itself. It's hitting the field.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, you've managed to really come up with a lot of good information here based on this stuff.
I hope.
Very impressed. I'm really impressed by your work. Do you have a particular favorite story of all the UFO, USO cases that you've compiled so far?
Well, I have one. It's in Poland. I know that. And it's, I think, in the 50s. The guy gives a description. He's walking along the beach. He's about to go home. It's the end of his vacation. And next thing he sees this bulging in the water way off about 1,000 feet out. And next thing he sees a depression underneath it. And then he sees the sucking and gurgling of the water. He's got everything in one case. Now, all the other cases I have, it usually has one aspect of this thing. He had all three in one case.
Huh.
So I said, this was fantastic. And, of course, when you're talking about favorite cases, you'd think that I'd love Shag Harbor. You'd think that.
Uh-oh.
Actually, I do. I mean, it's a fantastically documented. I talked to Chris Stiles. He says he's got a four-drawer file cabinet filled with U.S. and Canadian documents on the make-believe UFO Shag Harbor thing. The government's wasting a whole lot of paper saying, no, they don't exist, and yet Chris has four drawers of government documents on this thing. But for me, it doesn't do a darn thing. It goes into the water, it comes out of the water, and that's about it.
From what your research tells you and from what you looked at, you think that it was less a UFO crash and more just a straight-up UFO turning into USO?
First of all, a UFO and a USO is exactly the
same
thing. I hate that when they use a different acronym because underwater it's a UFO. I mean, if it was a fish and you didn't know what it was, okay, then it's an unidentified submerged object or whatever. But a UFO goes into the water, comes out of the water, it's still a UFO.
Okay, so you prefer UFO straight up and not USO?
Straight up. That's the reason I named the site Water UFO instead of USO or something like that. As far as the Shag Harbor goes, that was evidently a mechanical problem on a ship of some sort. And it was there for a week being repaired under the U.S. and Canadian ships right above it.
Huh.
You know that, right?
Yeah.
And they, according to Chris, they talked to a couple of divers who were sent down to look at it. That's only 60 feet of water. That's a six-story building.
Yeah.
That's not very deep. They had guys on the ship leaning over to look at the thing below them. So, I mean, a week, good God, you know, you talk about minutes or seconds, you know, in a regular sighting. And so here they had this thing there for a week. Incredible.
Yeah, and it sounds like they must not have had the field on because we wouldn't have those divers coming back up.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know how close the divers got, and of course, once you feel the heat, you're not going to go further into the heat.
You know, yeah.
You're going to go away from it. But as far as the field being on, I'm willing to bet it was. The reason being is you can't do repair work from one craft to the other without going through the field. So, as a matter of fact, that's going to be part of my presentation when I go to Nova Scotia for this thing in August. The two ships had to be one above the other, as far as I can see, in this kind of a magnetic field thing, because that creates one field. You know, you take a North Pole and a South Pole together, they attract. So if you have one craft above the other, and you put your South Pole of your craft on top of the North Pole of the other craft, you only have one field,
mm-hmm.
Not the two fields of the two separate magnets, only one field. And so you can walk out of your craft, no water, no field, and then go down to the second craft.
Interesting.
I never talked to any of the divers, and I haven't heard from Chris or Don on that end of the subject, but I'd be willing to bet on it. I really would.
We're pretty much at the wrap-up, but I did want to ask you about, on the subject of black projects and stuff like that, I see here you do have a section called the U.S. Navy and the Flying Submarines.
Oh.
was this an idea that...
they tried and you know, maybe didn't work out? Or what's the story behind the flying submarine?
Well, actually, there's two. One, I can't get permission to post because it's I forget what's who the manufacturer is. But this particular one is old. That goes back when?
65.
65, yeah. And what it was a proposal to find out a feasibility study. That's it, feasibility study, to see if they could invent a flying submarine. Now, this is nothing more than an aircraft that they open up ports and it sinks.
Mm-hmm.
And then it has an electric motor that pushes it forward underwater at a breakneck speed of 5 miles per hour. So needless to say, after this thing shoots off a torpedo, I think a rowboat could shoot it out of the water, you know?
Yeah.
But any of that, that was a feasibility study, $36,000 back in 65. And it showed that the Navy did have a great deal of interest in having a submarine that could fly. Well, needless to say, the Navy has 72% of the globe to play with, and they are there with water UFOs, and I'm sure they got the idea that it'd be a wonderful thing to imitate UFOs. As a matter of fact, there's a new one out about the same type of thing, except it's an unmanned craft, and it's launched from a submarine. I don't know whether from the deck or underneath, but it's launched from the submarine. It goes out on its own, flies out there, and then flies back and sinks back to the submarine. But it's a high-speed thing, so. But again, it's a proposal. It's not built yet, so.
How would you describe most of the sightings, from people on the shore, people on boats, just all of the sorts of different ways?
Oh, all over the place. Mostly shore, I would say, because, you know, be the shore of a river, shore of a lake, or whatever have you. But besides oceans, boats, you also have aircraft. I have one case that's a very big case that the guy saw lights on the water, and they said, hey, there's a town down there. We must be off and on navigation. It turned out they weren't off on a navigation, and they couldn't explain the lights. It was just too large for fishing boats. Well, next thing, the lights were up at their wingtip.
Wow.
So needless to say, they get from the water surface up to the air very quickly. So, yes, there's anywhere there's eyeballs, you can see the UFO.
And the UFO is usually described as like a light of some kind, right? Not just a solid sort of craft?
Well, light at night.
Yeah.
At night. Because, again, the ionized field causes it to look like a ball of light.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they saw on the surface of the water at night, was the lights. But in the daytime, the sunshine, the sun's rays filter out the colors. And all you see is the craft. The field is still there, but it filters out the colors.
Okay.
You don't see a ball of light, you see the craft.
So like a nighttime sighting of one of these would just be like a ball of light going into the water and then coming out of the water, but be in the water too.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you have a lot of like daytime sightings then where they actually see the craft, like a craft go in?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it works both ways. The only thing is you got to realize what the field is doing at what time of day. And that's the beauty of the whole picture. See, the advantage of water is that I'm watching a different medium. If you're dealing only with UFOs in the air, you're looking at an invisible thing to start with, air. Water has color and texture and various other things, but this all is visible when the UFO affects it. It's not visible in a regular atmosphere.
Yeah, yeah. So it gives us a fantastic opportunity to study the UFOs.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
What's coming up next for you, Carl? Are Keith and I going to have to get on your case here to get your book out?
I'm afraid so. I'm still collecting cases, and every time I put one up, that's just kind of a day's shot. And I am working on it. I have 6-7 chapters written.
Oh, nice.
And it'll explain all the stuff about the heat, the field, and everything else. And it has diagrams in each case. But there's a lot of other things I wanted to incorporate in the book. One, I just picked up secrecy, as a matter of fact. If you go through the aircraft carrier cases, that catalog you like.
Yeah.
I'm in the process of changing a lot of the text, some of the text in it, to show a maroon coloring, you know, highlighting.
Mm-hmm.
And that maroon highlighting specifies, I was told not to say a word about it. or, you know, it's a top secret thing. You know, in any case, there's 24 cases I have where the people are being told on the ship not to talk about it by their commanding officers. So, again, the secrecy thing is not only on land, not with the Air Force, but it's Navy as well.
Wow. So the book's sort of just up in the air. You're not sure exactly when.
Oh, no.
It's not something like we can say it'll be out at any certain time.
No. People have asked me about publishers, and I haven't even finished writing it yet. I've got to pass this through my son, the writer, and then through my grammarian, and see how well I fare on that. So, and I still got a lot of stuff to write about. I just got to get time together. That's it.
There you go, I'm sure.
I'd say at least a year.
All right. Well, you have to let me know what's going on with that, because we'll bring you back on the show. This USO subject, or UFOs in the water subject, fascinating stuff. Carl, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. The hour here has just flown by, and we've actually gone over the hour a little bit, and I really appreciate you giving me a little extra time here. I can't put over your research enough. This water UFO connection is fascinating stuff, and as you said, it really opens up a whole window to learn so much more about the UFOs that we ever could have really done by looking at UFOs in the air. And we owe you a great debt of gratitude just for your hard work in putting all these cases together and putting together such a fantastic website that allows for researchers to look at these UFO cases. I take my hat off to you, sir. You've done an outstanding job of research, and I really look forward to the eventual book from Carl Feint on the water UFO connection. Carl, thank you so much for coming on with All America Audio.
Thank you, sir.
That does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio Season 3. Big, big, super huge thanks to Carl Feint for returning to BOA Audio. Find out more information on Carl Feint at the tremendous website, waterufo.net. Pretty simple, all one word, waterufo.net. Check it out. It is an awesome website. Moving right along now, it's time for the return of BOA Audio Listener Feedback. This week's letter comes from Andrea. Here's what she has to say. Is there anywhere that you list the intro music that you play at the beginning of your shows? For example, the song before the first interview with Peter Robbins. It's a good song. I hadn't heard it in a long time, and I don't know who's performing it. Just want to close by saying that I appreciate your appreciation of the people on your show, both the interviewees and your writers. A number of years ago, I used to listen to another radio program, but was always put off by the host's ego and the way he treated a lot of his guests. I didn't care for that. You honor the people you interview, and I think that's important. It doesn't mean that you believe or agree with everything, but at least you're courteous, and it's a pleasure to hear that. Keep up the good work, Andrea. Thank you very much for writing in, Andrea. Regarding the intro music list, we do not have one put together, but that's something that I wanted to do when we first started the show, but never really got around to doing it. And as the archive got so big, it just sort of fell to the way back burner. Regarding the first installment interview with Peter Robbins, the intro music for that episode is Ripple by the Grateful Dead. Great tune. Gotta thank you for the nice things you say here at the close of the letter. Even though the show does have my name in it and the website has my name all over it, I try to keep my ego in check, which is difficult in this ego-filled genre that is esoterica. A lot of people want to be the star of their own show, and the guest takes a backseat to their own pontifications. I'm not really that sort of person. I believe the guest is the talent. I'm just the facilitator to get their talent over, and I believe it's always important to treat the guests with respect, whether you believe in their stuff or not. That doesn't mean I'm not going to challenge them on some of the stuff they say, but I'm also not going to live and die by challenging the guests, because in my opinion, that's the job of the listeners. It's their responsibility to decide whether they believe in a guest or not. It's not my job to tell them what to believe. Once again, thanks for writing in, Andrea. I appreciate the feedback and the question and the suggestion for the intro music list. If you would like to be a part of BOA Audio Listener Feedback, there's a number of ways to do it. A, write to boaaudio@hotmail.com or go to Banal of America and click the contact button. The third way, join up at the BOA Forum. theusofe.com, theusofe.com. That's the official BOA forum. Check it out. Hang out with us. We're raising hell there every day, talking about all sorts of stuff, esoterica and non-esoterica. Any of those methods will get your correspondence into my hands for a future installment of BOA Audio listener feedback. Up next, of course, the thanks part of the program. I got to give huge props and thanks to the fantastic BOA staff. Let me run down the list. Leslie, Chiron, Arlie, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, and our newest columnist, Richard Thomas from Wales. I got to say, one of the aspects of BOA that I'm proudest of is the fact that we're not just rolling out an audio show once a week and you never hear from us until the next show is posted. We've got a wealth of reading material posted to BOA day in, day out from the outstanding BOA staff. They are the ones who keep the website stocked Monday through Friday with fresh material. As we say here at the end of the program, week in and week out, if you're only listening to BOA audio and you're not reading the columns at beenallofamerica.com, you're only getting half the story. BOA, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. Getting near the close of the program, but first, before we get to the preview for next week, it's time for me to ask you to make a donation to BOA. As you may have noticed, we feature a lot of international guests on the program, lengthy calls to other countries, including South Africa, France, the UK, and Ireland, not to mention calls to all the way across America and all points in between. And as can be expected, that stuff costs serious money, not to mention the costs for hosting the audio, the bandwidth, and all that sort of stuff. All of these expenses are paid for out of pocket by yours truly, with help from supporters of BOA who make donations. How do you do that? It's simple. You go to beenallofamerica.com, click the PayPal button, and make a donation. No donation is too small, and all donations go towards keeping Been All of America and BOA Audio up and running and freely available to all of our great listeners and readers the world over. All right, time to preview next week's program. Let me just roll it out for you like this, my friends. One of the big players behind the scenes in esoterica, the prolific Smiles Lewis, joins BOA Audio for a two-hour jam session on all things esoteric. We're going to cover a host of paranormal topics from a number of different angles, notably the UFO scene, UFOs in general, 9/11, and the growth of the 9/11 truth movement. Smiles is going to take us back to the zine scene of the 1980s and early 90s, and talk about the explosion and evolution of the internet and esoterica. We're going to find out about all the various projects that Smiles is involved with, which span the spectrum of esoteric media, and of course tons and tons more. It's a very fast and loose edition of BOA Audio, next week with Smiles Lewis, one of the oftentimes unsung key figures in today's esoteric scene. And on that note, we wrap it up here for the week. Thank you for your patience during our spring break. I'm happy to be back, and I'm looking forward to rolling out some of these new episodes as we march towards the BOA Audio Season 3 season finale. Until next week, this is Tim Benall, thanking you for listening and signing off.